Chapter 10, Interpretation of Events. They presented a complete contrast, these two Earthmen, one with the greatest semblance of power on Earth, and one with the greatest reality. Thus, the High Minister was the most important Earthman on Earth, the recognized ruler of the planet by direct and definite decree of the Emperor of all the galaxy, subject, of course, to the orders of the Emperor's procurator. His secretary seemed no one at all, really, merely a member of the Society of Ancients appointed, theoretically, by the High Minister to take care of certain unspecified details and dismissible, theoretically, at will. The High Minister was known to all the Earth and was looked up to as the supreme arbiter on matters of custom. It was he who announced the exemptions to the 60, and it was he who judged the breakers of ritual, the defiers of rationing and of production schedules, the invaders of restricted territory, and so on. The secretary, on the other hand, was known to nobody, not even by name, except to the Society of Ancients, and of course to the High Minister himself. The High Minister had a command of language, and made frequent speeches to the people, speeches of high emotional content and copious flow of sentiment. He had fair hair, worn long, and a delicate and patrician countenance. The secretary, snub-nosed and wry-faced, preferred a short word to a long one, a grunt to a word, and silence to a grunt, at least in public. It was the High Minister, of course, who had the semblance of power, the secretary who had the reality, and in the privacy of the High Minister's office that circumstance was quite plain. For the High Minister was pettishly puzzled, and the secretary coolly indifferent. "What I don't see," said the High Minister, "is the connection of all these reports you bring me. Reports! Reports!" He lifted an arm above his head and struck viciously at an imaginary heap of paper. "I don't have the time for them." "Exactly," said the secretary coldly. "It is why you hire me. I read them, digest them, transmit them." "Well, good Balkis, about your business then, and quickly, since these are minor matters." "Minor? Your Excellency may lose a great deal some day if your judgment is not sharpened. Let us see what these reports mean, and I shall then ask you if you still consider them minor. First, we have the original report, now 7 days old, from Chet's underling, and it is that which first put me on the trail." "What trail?" Balkis's smile was faintly bitter. "May I recall to your Excellency certain important projects which have been nurtured here on Earth for several years?" The High Minister, in sudden loss of dignity, could not forbear looking about hastily. "Your Excellency, it is not nervousness but confidence that will win for us. You know further that the success of this project has depended upon the judicious use of Shet's little toy, the synapsifier. Until now, at least as far as we know, it has been utilized under our direction only and for definite purposes. And now, without warning, Shet has synapsified an unknown man in complete violation of our orders." "This," said the High Minister, "is a simple matter. Discipline Shet, take the treated man into custody, and end the matter." "No, no. You are far too straightforward, Your Excellency. You miss the point. It is not what Shet has done, but why he has done so. Note that there exists a coincidence about the matter, one of a considerable series of subsequent coincidences. The Procurator of Earth had visited Shet that same day, and Shet himself reported to us in loyal and trustworthy fashion all that had passed between them. Ennius had wanted the synapsifier for imperial use. He made promise, it seems, of great help and gracious assistance from the Emperor." "Said the High Minister. "You are intrigued. A compromise such as that seems attractive as compared to the dangers attending our present course. Do you remember the promises of food to us during the famine 5 years ago? Do you? Shipments were refused because we lacked imperial credits, and Earth-manufactured products would not be accepted as being radioactively contaminated. Was there a free gift of food as promised? Was there even a loan? 100,000 died of starvation. Don't put your trust in outsider promises. But that does not matter. What does is that Shek made a great display of loyalty. Surely we could never doubt him again. With compounded certainty, we could not suspect him of treason that very day. Yet, so it came to pass. You mean in this unauthorized experiment, Balkis? I do, Your Excellency. Who was the man treated? We have photographs of him, and with the help of Shek's technician, retinal patterns. A check with the planetary registry shows no record of him. The conclusion must therefore be reached that he is no Earthman, but an outsider. Furthermore, Shek must have been aware of it, since a registration card cannot be forged or transferred if checked with retinal patterns. So, in simple fashion, the unalterable facts lead us to the conclusion that Shek has synapsified, knowingly, an outsider. And why? The answer to that may be disturbingly simple. Shek is not an ideal instrument for our purposes. In his youth, he was an assimilationist. He even once stood for election to the Washin Council on a platform of conciliation with the Empire. He was defeated, by the way. The High Minister interrupted, "I didn't know that." "That he was defeated?" "No, that he ran." "Why wasn't I informed of this? Shek is a very dangerous man in the position he now holds." Balkis smiled softly and tolerantly. "Shek invented the synapsifier and still represents the one man truly experienced in its operation. He has always been watched and will now be watched more closely than ever. Do not forget that a traitor within our ranks, known to us, can do more harm to the enemy than a loyal man can do good to us. Now, let us continue to deal with the facts. Shek has synapsified an outsider. Why? There is only one reason why a synapsifier can possibly be used: to improve a mind. And why that? Because only so can the minds of our scientists, already improved by synapsification, be overtaken, eh? This means that the Empire has at least a faint suspicion of what is going on upon Earth. Is that minor, Your Excellency? There was a scattered dew on the High Minister's forehead. Do you really think so? The facts are a jigsaw puzzle that can fit only one way. The outsider so treated was a man of undistinguished, even contemptible appearance. A good stroke, too, since a bald and fat old man can still be the Empire's most skilled espionage agent. Oh, yes. Yes. Who else could be trusted on a mission such as this? But we have followed this stranger, whose alias, by the way, is Schwartz, as far as we can. Let us take this second file of reports. The High Minister cast an eye upon them. The ones concerning Bell Arvardhan? Dr. Bell Arvardhan, assented Balkis, eminent archaeologist of the gallant Syrian sector, those worlds of brave and chivalrous bigots. He spat the last out. Then, well, never mind. In any case, we have here a queer mirror image to Schwartz, an almost poetic contrast. He is not unknown, but instead a famous figure. He is not a secret intruder, but one who comes floating on a tidal wave of publicity. We are warned of him not by an obscure technician, but by the Procurator of Earth himself. Do you think there is a connection, Balkis? Your Excellency may suppose it possible that one may be designed to distract our attention from the other. Or else, since the ruling classes of the Empire are skilled enough in intrigue, we have an example of two methods of camouflage. In the case of Schwartz, the lights are put out. In the case of Arvidun, the lights are flashed in our eyes. In neither case are we intended to see anything. Come. Of what did Ennius warn us concerning Arvidun? The High Minister rubbed his nose thoughtfully. Arvidun, he said, was on an archaeological expedition under imperial sponsorship and wished to enter the forbidden areas for scientific purposes. No sacrilege, he said, was intended, and if we could stop him in gentle fashion, he would back our action to the Imperial Council, something like that. So, then we will watch Arvidun closely. But for what purpose? Why, to see that he makes no unauthorized entry into the forbidden areas. He is the head of an archaeological expedition without men, ships, or equipment. He is an outsider who does not remain at Everest, where he belongs, but wanders about Earth for some reason, and goes to Shikha first. And how is our attention distracted from all these most curious and suspicious circumstances? Why, by urging us to watch carefully something that is of no importance. But notice, Your Excellency, that Schwartz was kept hidden in the Institute for Nuclear Research for 6 days, and then he escaped. Isn't that strange? The door suddenly wasn't locked. The corridor suddenly wasn't guarded. What queer negligence. And on what day was it that he escaped? Why, on the same day that Arvidun arrived at Shikha. A second peculiar coincidence. You think, then, said the High Minister tensely, I think that Schwartz is the outsider agent on Earth, that Schecht is the contact man with the assimilationist traitors among us, and that Arvidun is the contact man with the Empire. Observe the skill with which the meeting between Schwartz and Arvidun was arranged. Schwartz is allowed to escape, and after an appropriate interval his nurse, Schecht's daughter, by a not too surprising additional coincidence, is out after him. If anything were to go wrong with their split-second timetable, it is obvious that she would have found him suddenly, that he would have become a poor, sick patient for the benefit of anyone's curiosity, that he would have been brought back to safety for another attempt later. In fact, two overcurious cabbies were told that he was a sick man and that, ironically enough, backfired upon them. Follow it closely now. Schwartz and Arvidun meet first in a foodomat. They are, apparently, unaware of each other's existence. It is a preliminary meeting, designed simply to indicate that all has gone well so far, and that the next step may be taken. At least they don't underestimate us, which is gratifying. Then Schwartz leaves. A few minutes later, Arvidun leaves, and the Schecht girl meets him. It is stopwatch timing. Together, after playing a little part for the benefit of the aforementioned cabbies, they head for the Dunham department store, and now all three are together. Where else but a department store? It is an ideal meeting place. It has a secrecy no cave in the mountains could duplicate. Too open to be suspected, too crowded to be stalked. Wonderful, wonderful. I give credit to my opponent. The High Minister writhed in his chair. If our opponent deserves too much credit, he will win. Impossible. He is already defeated. And in that respect, we must give credit to the excellent Natter. And who is Natter? An insignificant agent who must be used to the limit after this. His actions yesterday could not have been improved upon. His long-range assignment has been to watch Schecht. For the purpose, he keeps a fruit stand across the street from the Institute. For the last week, he has been specifically instructed to watch the development of the Schwartz affair. He was on hand when the man, known to him through photographs, and through a glimpse at the time he was first brought to the Institute, escaped. He observed every action, himself unobserved, and it is his report that details yesterday's events. With incredible intuition, he decided that the entire purpose of the escape was to arrange a meeting with Arvidan. He felt himself to be not in a position single-handed to exploit that meeting, so he decided to prevent it. The cabbies, to whom the Schecht girl had described Schwartz as being sick, speculated on radiation fever. Natter seized on that with the swiftness of genius. As soon as he observed the meeting in a department store, he reported the case of fever, and the local authorities at Schicka were, praised be Earth, intelligent enough to cooperate quickly. The store was emptied, and the camouflage which they counted upon to hide their conversation was stripped from them. They were alone and very conspicuous in the store. Natter went further. He approached them and talked them into allowing him to escort Schwartz back to the Institute. They agreed. What could they do? So that the day ended without a single word passing between Arvidan and Schwartz. Nor did he commit the folly of arresting Schwartz. The two are still in the ignorance of their detection and will yet lead us to bigger game. And Natter went further still. He notified the Imperial garrison, and that is beyond praise. It presented Arvidan with a situation he could not possibly have counted upon. He must either reveal himself to be an outsider and destroy his usefulness, which apparently depends upon conducting himself upon Earth as though he were an Earthman, or he must keep the fact secret and subject himself to whatever unpleasantness might result. He took the more heroic alternative, and even broke the arm of an officer of the Empire in his passion for realism. That, at least, must be remembered in his favor. It is significant that his actions were as they were. Why should he, an outsider, expose himself to the neuronic whip for an Earth girl, if the matter at stake was not supremely important? Both fists of the High Minister were on the desk before him. He glowered savagely, the long, smooth lines of his face crumpled in distress. It is well for you, Balkis, from such meager details, to construct the spider-web you do. It is skillfully done, and I feel that it is as you say. Logic leaves us no other alternative. But it means that they are too close, Balkis. They are too close. And they will have no mercy this time. Balkis shrugged. They cannot be too close, or in a case of such potential destructiveness for all the Empire, they would have already struck. And their time is running short. Arvidan must still meet with Schwartz if anything is to be accomplished, and so I can predict for you the future. Do so, do so. Schwartz must be sent away now, and events allowed to quiet down from their current high pitch. But where will he be sent? We know that, too. Schwartz was brought to the Institute by a man, obviously a farmer. Descriptions reached us from both Schett's technician and from Natter. We went through the registration data of every farmer within 60 miles of Schicka, and Natter identified one Arbin Marin as the man. The technician supported that decision independently. We investigated the man quietly, and it seems that he is supporting a father-in-law, a helpless cripple, in evasion of the 60. The High Minister pounded the table. Such cases are entirely too frequent, Balkis. The laws must be tightened. It is not now the point, Your Excellency. What is important is the fact that since the farmer is violating the customs, he can be blackmailed. Oh. Schecht and his outsider allies need a tool for just such a case. That is, where Schwartz must remain in seclusion for a longer period than he can safely stay hidden in the Institute. This farmer, probably helpless and innocent, is perfect for the purpose. Well, he will be watched. Schwartz will never be out of sight. Now, eventually another meeting between him and Arvidin will have to be arranged, and that time we will be prepared. Do you understand everything now?
I do.
Well, praise Earth. Then I will leave you now. And with a sardonic smile, he added, with your permission, of course. And the High Minister, completely oblivious to the sarcasm, waved a hand in dismissal. The secretary, on his way to his own small office, was alone. And when alone, his thoughts sometimes escaped from beneath his firm control and disported themselves in the secrecy of his mind. They concerned themselves very little with Dr. Schett, Schwartz, Arvidin, least of all with the High Minister. Instead, there was the picture of a planet, Trantor, from whose huge planet-wide metropolis all the galaxy was ruled. And there was the picture of a palace, whose spires and sweeping arches he had never seen in reality, that no other Earthman had ever seen. He thought of the invisible lines of power and glory that swept from sun to sun in gathering strings, ropes, and cables to that central palace, and to that abstraction, the Emperor, who was, after all, merely a man. His mind held that thought fixedly, the thought of that power which could alone bestow a divinity during life, concentrated in one who was merely human, merely human, like himself. He could be